holding patterns. We're rarely asked to do them anymore, but we still need to know how. I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller, flight instructor in the Buffalo, New York area, whose newsletter, Over the Airwaves, is the journal for the proficient pilot. You can find it on the web at overtheairwaves.com. In your current edition of Over the Airwaves, Bob, you wrote about holding patterns and how they've kind of become a vestige of an earlier era, but not really. What do we need to still know about holding patterns?
Two things we need to know about holding patterns, and that is how to find our way there and how to maintain our altitude. And I guess there's a third thing, remain on the safe side or on the holding side of the holding pattern that we're directed to get into. The point I was trying to make in the article was our obsession with whether or not we make parallel entries or teardrop entries or direct entries into the holding pattern. Frankly, I don't. ATC themselves, they really can't tell how we get into a holding pattern. And if we look at the regulations pertaining to that, it comes out of the Airman's Information Manual, and these are strictly advisory suggestions or recommendations. Mm-hmm. They're not regulatory.
Well, now, obviously, with the emphasis on saving fuel these days, fuel has become more than a third of airline operating expenses. I guess we could expect holding patterns to be avoided at all costs by air traffic controllers, in the current environment. But specifically, if we're going to fly IFR, we need to know about these things no matter how infrequently we practice them, because there might be, sudden weather conditions or something happening on the ground that would require them.
Yes, and they do need to be practiced. They certainly do. One of the points I was attempting to make is that holding patterns today are not nearly as prevalent in use as they were a number of years ago, thanks to flow control that ATC at the command center uses to keep airplanes on the ground before departing to their destination if the arrival traffic is such that they cannot accommodate them. But in my experience, I've been put into a hold less than a half a dozen times in all of my flying years, and any time I have been placed in a hold, it was usually for no more than maybe one turn in the hold. But where it does provide a problem, or it can provide a problem, is for those of us who have become dependent on GPS. If the holding fix is depicted and it's a published fix, then of course it'll be displayed on the GPS moving map. But sometimes we'll get a holding instruction that says hold on a VOR radial DME fix, and that DME fix will not be displayed on a glass panel or on a glass moving map GPS. Here we have to go back to the older skills of being able to navigate via VORs. So the point you raise is, while they're not as prevalent as they used to be in terms of use, there are some occasions where we're going to have to be able to find them without using that GPS capability that we have.
Well, now, this raises an interesting question as we transition to a completely satellite-based navigational system over the next decade or two, and that is when DME is no longer a piece of required equipment. How will this be executed? How will it be instructed?
Well, we can do it because GPS satisfies the DME requirement. So if we're shooting an approach, for example, that requires requires DME, an approach-certified GPS will qualify as DME. But in the example, and I guess I did have this fairly recently, I was instructed to hold on a VOR radial at a 20 or 25 DME fix. And so I was able to use the GPS to provide the DME information, but I had to switch over to VOR navigation and put in the VOR radio frequency and then center the needle on that VOR radio and then combine information from the GPS with the VOR. So when you mention when we become totally satellite-based navigation, I suppose that will one day go away, land-based navigation, and that won't be a problem any longer. But until then, it gets back to a discussion we had a week or so ago when we talked about automatic transmissions versus standard transmissions. We're kind of in the middle of both technologies today.
I'm not familiar enough with flying GPS in an IFR environment to know how a DME a fix works in GPS, if you're instructed to fly a circle around a point that is not defined in your database, is there a way to quickly define that and let the autopilot handle that part, or do you have to do it all manually?
There's two questions there. The first part is, yes, we can define it with the GPS because the fix has got to be around a nav 8 of some sort if they're using the older style. So it's typically around a VOR. So we can if it's a G1000 setup, all we have to do is dial in that particular VOR frequency, and then we'll get a constant DME readout from our GPS G1000 telling us exactly how far we are from that fix. And so it's easy to do, but we just have to have an understanding of how the VOR radials work. And the second question you have is, will the autopilot fly that circle? Well, that depends. It depends on the autopilot that we have equipped in the airplane. But in some cases it will, in some cases it won't. You can use the autopilot, but you have to use it in something called heading mode and just physically turn the airplane with the autopilot around the arc.
Okay. Well, listen, enough on this. I want to move on to a very interesting topic from the March 1st edition of Over the Airwaves regarding human factors. We'll do that in a moment. Bob Miller is my guest. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves and of Bob Miller Flight Training Incorporated in the Buffalo, New York area. We're talking about safety issues as we do each Monday. And Bob, you wrote in your March 1st edition of Over the Airwaves about a unique human factors discussion that ended up being prompted by your daughter. And I thought this was fascinating how this occurred. Get us into the story a little bit.
Well, my daughter just turned 18 this past month. And one of her birthday wishes was to fly down to New York City for a day of shopping. And she had set her sights on doing that, and she wanted to do it on her birthday. And having been raised in an airplane-owning family, she had no qualms about, or no doubts that this indeed would happen. Well, as facts unfolded on that particular day of her birthday, we headed out to the airport, and we were just enshrouded in fog, ground fog, and with a forecast that it was going to lift later in the morning. But as we approached the airport and actually drove out on the ramp area to get to the hangar, it was apparent to me that the fog was not going to lift. And Erica looked at me as I turned the car around, headed back home, and she said, "Dad, where are you going?" And I said, "You know, Erica, we can't make it out here today. I mean, I can't see the trees at the end of the runway." And she looked at me almost in dismay and says, "What do you mean? We've taken off in low weather before." And I said, "Yes, but this is, you know, we're in sub-freezing conditions, and we've got turbulent air above, and we've got icing, and this just isn't going to work." And Erica had found herself in the midst of a quotation that I had used in that article, which said, "Lovers of air travel find it exhilarating to hang poised between the illusion of immortality and the fact of death." Erica had found herself hanging too close to that illusion of immortality, and she was quite put out with me for not taking that flight on that particular morning.
Well, Bob, you know, you bring this up, and it's an interesting family anecdote in the terms you wrote it. But frankly, what her experience, what her background was, is similar in a way to the background of a lot of corporate flyers. I mean, we hear stories all the time about accidents where it appears that get their itis on the part of a passenger who also happened to be the employer of the pilot may have been a factor in the decision making that led to an accident.
Oh, far too many times, Paul. You're absolutely right. And if it's a young pilot with mouths to feed at home and he's faced with an employer who's saying fly or resign, That takes a fairly strong-willed pilot to say no to a situation like that. But even beyond that, I think any of us who have succeeded, who have tried something risky in the past and have succeeded in it, become reinforced in the notion that, hey, I've done this before, I ought to be able to do this again without looking at extenuating circumstances. In my case, Erica was right. I mean, I have no qualms about flying off into a 100-foot or 200-foot ceiling. I don't. If the weather is warm and icing is not a factor, and I can reach, in many cases, good VFR conditions up on top, or I have a nearby airport that I can get into as an alternate if something happens. But on days that she didn't really quite understand, nor did I expect her to understand what sub-freezing temperatures, how that would influence the decision to launch into a low cloud or low fog bound day.
Well, I think back to an anecdote I heard about an accident in which everybody aboard the aircraft died, where it was a corporate flight and the pilot and the co-pilot were found in the wreckage with a bunch of $100 bills stuffed in their shirt pockets. And the obvious message there was that there was somebody in the back of that plane who really, really wanted to get there and said, I'll make it worth your while to keep trying. Mm-hmm. And, obviously we have to sometimes be as aware of the passengers' get their itis as we do our own. But I think that either way, reading this article about what your daughter went through that day and what it made you go through is an interesting preparation for that discussion, whether it's with ourselves or with our passengers.
Well, I think what scared me most, and I really want to say this, I think what concerned me most was if it was me by myself, would I have done it? I at that particular day, as any parent would know, this was my most precious cargo. And would I be inclined to take a risk if it were by myself that I would not be inclined to risk if it were one of your children or members of your family? In all cases, the outcome should have been exactly the same, whether it's by ourselves or with our families. The greatest fear that I have would be to hurt a family member in an airplane, far less than hurting myself. But again, we have to discipline ourselves. If it's not safe to take your precious cargo, in the bottom analysis, the final analysis, who's more precious than yourself?
Well, if it's not safe to take your most precious cargo, it's also not appropriate to deprive her of her father.
That's right.
Well, Bob, I appreciate your thoughts. We'll encourage people to go to overtheairwaves.com and check out more of them. We'll talk to you again on Monday next week.
Thanks, Paul. See you then.
You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at www.aero.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day. Okay.